inconsolable. Think of a time in your life when you were inconsolable. When a crushing loss, an unbearable burden of guilt, a broken heart, a throbbing pain, an injustice inflicted on you or on someone you love, left you utterly vulnerable and absolutely defended in the same breath. Your mind numbed, your spirit shattered, your soul isolated. Israel was inconsolable. The crushing loss of temple, nation, and king, the guilt of their own idolatry and disobedience, the collective broken heart in the wake of God's abandonment, a throbbing pain now become a dull ache after decades in exile, a collective sense that their punishment was less and less fitting the crime. God's people were utterly vulnerable and absolutely defended in the same breath. Minds numb, spirits shattered, souls isolated. How had this happened to a people who were God's people? Beginning with their disobedience and the destruction of the temple, then throughout the endless march to Babylon, and finally over these past 50 years in exile, God had been silent. In fact, the children and the grandchildren of the original exiles had only known themselves as abandoned by God. Enter 2nd Isaiah, the prophet of consolation. Comfort, oh, comfort my people, Isaiah says to Israel, at what Walter Brueggemann called Israel's null punct, the zero of Israel's life. Comfort, oh, comfort my people. The surmise is that the prophet lived among them, was one of them. And this little guess leads me to say in the first place that when you are inconsolable, at the null point, the zero point of your life, comfort can only come from one who is present with you just there, in the darkness, the despair, the hopelessness. What really counts in moments of pain and suffering, priest and theologian Henry Nouwen writes, is that someone stays with us. More important than any particular action or word of advice is the simple presence of someone who cares, who says, I don't know what to say or what to do, but I want you to realize that I am with you, that I will not leave you alone. Except notice that the words of comfort in Isaiah are not Isaiah's. Comfort, oh comfort my people, says your God. God commands Isaiah to comfort God's people. The prophet is mediating God's comfort as he speaks God's word to them just there, in the darkness, the despair, the hopelessness. Likewise, the God who comforts sends us what I just said to the children. The God who comforts sends us. Perhaps the most vivid experience of the God who comforts in this way was given me by a member of my previous church whose schizophrenia landed him in Trenton State Psychiatric Hospital. For months, I visited him and listened in as he talked to the He said that he had prayed and prayed and prayed to God, asking God to help him out of the darkness of his mental illness, and God was silent. Then he stopped, looked at me, and said, matter-of-factly, "But you are here, I suppose, because God sent you." I take that to mean that the comfort we give to each other, in the second place, is not only ours, but God's. When I darken the door of your hospital room, or visit you in the valley of the shadow of death, I come as one who has been sent to you by the God who comforts. So too, the God of comfort sends you to the inconsolable, even if you do not know the right words to say. Friends and strangers, deacons and ministers, mediate God's comfort simply by showing up and continuing to show up just there in the darkness, in the despair, in the hopelessness. Then in the third place, the God who comforts as God has mercy on us. It's a particular way of God's comfort. The prophet begins to speak tenderly to Jerusalem, to his fellow exiles, to speak to their hearts. He cries to them that they have suffered enough, that their unbearable burden of guilt has been taken from them, and that the punishment inflicted upon them by God is over. It is not theirs any longer. It is God's. That's what mercy is. Mind you, they had been in exile for 50 years. On one hand, they got up every morning and they did what they had to do to live. You know how that goes when you're inconsolable. You get up, you do what you have to do. They even prospered in Babylon and could have gone to their graves as productive members of Babylonian society. But on the other hand, they had yet to reckon with what was lost. The mercy of the God who comforts begins to wring out of our inconsolable selves the hard work of lament and complaint. In Brueggemann's words, the first work of exiles is the work of relinquishing what is gone, of resisting every denial, every act of nostalgia, of acknowledging and embracing what has ended. I know the thing I want is the thing I can never get, C.S. Lewis laments late in A Grief Observed. The old life, the jokes, the drinks, the arguments, the lovemaking, the tiny, heartbreaking commonplace. Yet in the midst of his lament, Lewis likens the God who comforts to a surgeon whose intentions are wholly good. The kinder and more conscientious he is, the more inexorably he will go on cutting. If he yielded to your entreaties, if he stopped before the operation were complete, all the pain up to that point would have been useless. Lament demands a season of its own, this season. Israel will not soon have done with its sense of loss, variously expressed in grief And the fourth place, can the God of comfort create in us a future? With room forged in the people's heart where grief and anger had been before, the exiles are prepared to receive what is inexplicably and inscrutably given by God, prepared to resist every measure of despair, prepared to await and affirm what God beyond every quid pro quo will give. The faith of Israel envisions no automatic move from relinquishment to reception, from letting go to receiving, rather than hurries to admit this. One does not follow necessarily from or after the other. You go in and out of both. Still, Israel's poets, singers, and speakers of oracles heard as the very assurance of God's own voice arise precisely at the null point, at the zero place, at the lowest point in Israel's life, and so too in your life and mine. Now to proclaim the good news of a humanly inconceivable future. Get thee up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good tidings. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good tidings. Lift it up. It is as though the prophet now finally gets high enough out of the darkness and onto the mountain to see the horizon, to see horizon, the future that was long obscured by tears of anger or blinding tears of grief, now comes into view. Again, you know how that goes. Tangibly, if you will permit an English major this tangent, the future tense begins to reappear in the speech of the prophet. There is an actual sense in which every human use of the future tense of the verb to be, George Snyder writes, is a negation, however limited, of the power of death. Even as every use of an if sentence tells of the refusal of the brute inevitability, the despotism of the fact. Shall, will, if are the passwords to hope. Take away energizing anticipation, take away the imperative of waiting that Advent is, and these tenses are unstopped, silenced. Listen again now. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every hill shall be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, the rough places plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together. For the mouth of the Lord, the mouth of the God of comfort, has spoken this. Future tenses, Snyder says, are the idiom of the messianic. So it is that these inconsolable exiles begin to hope again. Isaiah's subjunctive mood points God's people toward the coming of the God whom they hope will rule with might, will feed them as a shepherd and gather them as lambs in his arms, will carry them in his bosom, and will gently lead the mother sheep home. Future tenses are the idiom of the messianic. Still, future tenses are the idiom of the Messianic. On the second Sunday of Advent, Isaiah has been sent to inconsolable exiles living a long way from home. He has been sent to you and to me, just here in the darkness. He speaks a word of comfort we cannot say to ourselves, a word that is not his but God's. He mercifully tells us that our warfare with each other and with God is ended, all evidence to the contrary. And he is presently inviting us to lament, relinquish what is gone, resist every denial, every act of nostalgia. Embrace what has ended. That we live in a time and among a people determined to hold on to what used to be, to indulge in nostalgia, to quit the future tense for the past tense when we were great. We are utterly vulnerable and completely defended. I think this is because living unconsciously at the null point, the zero, evokes deep and raw fear. Fear in the face of a future that is not in our hands, but in God's. So finally, Isaiah says, do not fear. He says this at the last to the cities, to this city. Do not fear. Here is your God. In your pain and uncertainty, God will come to you. In your struggle, your healing, God will carry you. In your recovery, your unfolding, God will feed you. In your brokenness and your guilt,